This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Elizabeth Lynn, the Executive Director of Valparaiso University's Institute for Leadership and Service. The 2018 Spring Pathways to Purpose Lecture Series is underway. We'll find out more about it and the people who are coming to campus to talk. Also, another conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. And we'll wrap up a series of reports from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Charlotte Tuggle about getting women involved in university computer science programs. That and more coming up, including Phil Potempa in the studio. Valparaiso University's Institute for Leadership and Service is continuing to offer its very special speaker series called Pathways to Purpose. And to talk about it, we have the Executive Director of the Institute with us, Elizabeth Lynn. Elizabeth, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
No, nice to talk to you, Chris.
And we know that the program has already started on Valparaiso University with the first speaker, Crystal Clark Briscoe. Tell us what Crystal had to talk about.
Yes, each semester we bring in five or six really remarkable practitioners of leadership and service. We bring them to Valparaiso University. They spend a day on campus getting to know our students, faculty, and staff. We welcome community members as well to come to their public talks in the evening. And the goal of the program overall is to expand imagination about how we can lead and serve in the world, and particularly to show students how they can connect what they studied when they were at Valpo with those very creative pathways that leaders take to put their studies to work in service to the world. Crystal Clark Briscoe is a graduate of Valparaiso University and has served in a variety of capacities as a lawyer. She's currently at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame as a legal counsel. She'd also worked in the administration of Mayor Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, mm-hmm. and had also been in private practice. And so she talked about the different ways one can learn lawyering and also how to serve through the law, both in the private and the public sector and the nonprofit sector, as she's now located. And just in her reflections on her service through the South Bend mayoral administration, she talked really movingly about the importance of ethics in leadership and that administration's deep commitment to transparency and accountability. And it really was very impactful. She's a native of the region, grew up in Gary, went to Valpo, Notre Dame, serving in South Bend, and really somebody to follow and to learn from.
The next in the series is coming up on February 7th, and that's going to be an interesting one. I guess the title of the presentation is Found in Translation, Using Language to Lead and Serve. Tell us about the speaker and why that happened to be chosen for the name of the topic.
Yeah, well, Sandra Album is the speaker. She's the CEO of Album Translation Services, which is based in Washington, D.C. And through our speaker series, we really seek out people who have majored in, you know, in their undergraduate work, they may have majored in fields like, in her case, it was Spanish and Spanish linguistics, and then put them to work in the world in a way that serves larger purposes, larger goods. She's a fascinating person. She's a two-time Jeopardy game show champion. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in people who have gotten in there and actually won that game, she would be interesting to talk to. But she's really brought her language skills, fluency in English, Spanish, and Catalan, to work to serve clients in a multilingual world. And I think for anybody who's studying language and wants to think about how they can put that to work, she would really be an interesting person to hear from. She is the only Catalan interpreter within 100 miles of Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And that's a distinction that allowed her the privilege of interpreting for the world-famous Barca soccer team. Mm-hmm. So that's really something. So how do you put your capacity to translate and to interpret, to work, to help people understand each other better in this global environment?
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great topic that she's going to bring up and probably give some answers to that question in particular.
Yeah.
Looking forward to her visit here.
All of our speakers, the public presentations are on Wednesdays.
Mm-hmm.
So all the dates I'll be giving will be Wednesdays. You can also go to our website, Institute for Leadership and Service at Valparaiso University. Just Google that. We'll come up and look up our schedule there. But she's speaking at 5:30 p.m. in the Helgi Center, which is attached to the Chapel of the Resurrection, which is at the center of our campus.
Mm-hmm.
And we do welcome folks from the community to come hear her.
That's right. We're talking with Elizabeth Lynn, who is the Executive Director of Valparaiso University's Institute for Leadership and Service. And we're talking in particular about the Spring 2018 Pathways to Purpose Speaker Series. And there's another series, of speeches coming up on February 21st. Tell us about this this digital age lady and why she's so important.
Yeah, she is definitely a digital age lady. Her name is Eva Krakul, and she's the executive director and co-founder of something called Glitch. Now, isn't that a great name for an organization? Glitch promotes the exploration of digital games as a culture, career, and creative practice. So they're a community-driven arts and education center based in the Twin Cities in Minnesota for emerging game makers, and they offer ongoing programs, events, residencies, and grants to support these emerging creators, makers, thinkers, and doers of new work in digital games.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very creative idea, and it would be wonderful to hear how she came up with it. I mean, the idea of a community organization that supports emerging digital game makers who are not recognized as established by others and who take risks and embrace challenges. That's a very creative kind of thing to do. And so how did Eva Krakul come to that?
Mm-hmm.
She studied neuroscience and psychology at the University of Minnesota. And we will help her tell her story of her pathway to purpose from studying those fields to creating something called Glitch.
Oh. Well, it'd be very interesting. I'm looking forward to find out more about her. Now, yeah. The series takes a break in March and comes back in April 25th, to be exact here, and kind of jumping over to the distaff side, we have a gentleman who's coming to campus to talk about investing in innovation. Tell us what Stephen Lehman's going to have to talk about.
Yeah. So Stephen Lehman's coming from a short distance, just the University of Chicago in Hyde Park in Chicago. He's a graduate of Valparaiso University. He did his bachelor's in mechanical engineering. Again, it's interesting to think, how does one get from mechanical engineering to investing in innovation at the University of Chicago? He holds an MBA from Notre Dame as well, and he studied the humanities. He is the assistant director of the University of Chicago Innovation Fund, which is an early-stage fund dedicated to the commercialization of research and technology generated at the university. So they invest in promising startups from an ecosystem that includes not only the University of Chicago, but Argonne National Laboratory, Fermilab, and the Marine Biological Laboratory. Their core mission is to help researchers turn their innovations into ventures that advance cutting-edge technologies, generate significant financial returns, and create lasting impact for humankind. Again, it's interesting to think about how this kind of support of startups and technology can also be joined to our deepest values about what is of importance, what is good for humankind. And he's clearly thinking about that. And we'll be talking about that on April 25th, again at 5:30 p.m., and again in the Helgi Center at Valparaiso University.
Now, this last in the series, the Pathways to Purpose series, is coming up on May 2nd. In fact, somebody I've heard of, and you may have heard her too, certainly NPR's Code Switch team oftentimes contributes features and stories to Morning Edition and All Things Considered and some of the other news magazines on NPR that you get to hear on Lakeshore Public Radio. But we get to have one of the founding members of Code Switch joining us here for this very special conversation. Tell us what Kat Chow is saying she's going to talk about.
Well, she's going to talk about telling complicated stories. And she really will help focus our attention on how we tell the complicated stories of race, ethnicity, and culture in our own society. She's just a remarkable person. She appears on NPR in a variety of contexts. Mm-hmm. So you might have heard her. She's an occasional chair on NPR's podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour. She's worked with the show Invisibilia. And so she's also been involved with Local Lore. So those are all for NPR nerds. Those are all some names to catch.
We picked her up on some of the Invisibilia pieces before on our programs, too. Yeah.
Excellent. Wonderful program. And she is a founding member of Code Switch. Now, that's an award-winning team that covers these complicated stories that really weave through our experience every day here in Northwest Indiana and elsewhere. Stories of race, ethnicity, and culture. Mm-hmm. She makes new episodes for the Code Switch podcast, so you can check that out if you want to listen to the podcast. Reports online for Code Switch, and also does on-air pieces for shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
Right. We should make a note, too, that Kat's presentation on May 2nd is not going to be at the Helge Center, as usual, but it is going to be in a very special place because we're expecting a big crowd to hear her. That's going to happen at the Duesenberg Recital Hall, isn't it?
Yes, that's in the Valparaiso University Center for the Arts, and is a lovely, lovely, small, but slightly larger than our own space here at the Helge Center Recital Hall. So you would want to get here early to get a seat, but you will really be in a very intimate and comfortable recital hall, getting to hear it from this phenomenal creative person in the world of radio, and also thinking about race, culture, gender, and identity. Yeah. May 2nd, and it's also, I just want to mention, it's at 5 p.m., 5:30 that night.
Okay, and that's going to be a great way to close out the Pathways to Purpose series for the spring of 2018. And once again, Elizabeth, if anybody has any questions, they'd like to get the list of the speakers, we kind of run down them here briefly, where folks find that list.
Yeah, just go to the Valparaiso University website and search for Institute for Leadership and Service, or just Google Pathways to Purpose at valpo.edu, and it'll pop right up. And so all the details are there. You can also follow us on Facebook, Institute for Leadership and Service at Valparaiso University. We have a very savvy social media team, and they keep it very well populated with information about our programs. We have not just Pathways to Purpose, but other public events we support from time to time throughout the year. And if you haven't been to the campus of Valparaiso University recently or at all, this is a great way to get to know us as a, I think, a real treasure in the region, in the country, and in the world. So I hope your listeners will come and join us on their own Pathways to Purpose.
Well, I certainly hope so, too. Elizabeth Lynn, thank you very much for telling us about this particular interesting series as it continues on for the spring of 2018 and all the great speakers coming to Valparaiso University this spring. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Chris. Take care.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Gary was the place you went to shop, and when it was a very successful community. We either drove there, my parents drove us there, or when we got a little older, we would just take the bus to downtown Gary. And there was every kind of shop you could think of. And at Christmas time, it was shoulder to shoulder walking up to down the street doing Christmas shopping. It was thriving. I grew up in a Lake Station, which it was East Gary when I grew up in it. And originally, it was Lake Station back in the 1800s and early 1900s. And then they changed their name to East Gary when, you know, the mills were starting to go and they wanted the executives to move there, so they changed it. Then when things got bad in Gary, they changed it back to Lake Station. I thought that is very telling. It was a typical suburban kind of neighborhood. It was very working class. In fact, they were going to high school there. everybody's parents made about the same amount of money. They worked in the mills. So in that way, it was probably different than a lot of other places because none of us were aspiring to be the rich kid in school. There were no rich kids in school. Patrick and I were married in 1966, and we moved to Miller in 1967, and we moved with a young baby. At that time, Miller was thriving. The downtown area had every kind of store you can think of. It was jewelry stores and bookstores and coffee shops and dress shops and Jack Spratt's ice cream shop, which was drew people from all over. And it was the funnel to the beach. I mean, hundreds of people would come to the beach during the summer from all over. It started to change really in the 70s. And with so many things, early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, with all of the things that were going on nationally and locally, you know, the war had an impact on the economy, the Vietnam War. The mills were at their heights and then started, you know, the economy was changing, the technology was changing so that less people were needed in the mills. And the whole suburban sprawl had an impact on little downtowns like Miller. It happened everywhere in the country, and it certainly happened here in Indiana with the other small communities. So at some point, there weren't a lot of businesses on the street, and those that were weren't thriving. A lot of the people left. They moved to Munster. That's how Munster got built. And the people who stayed are still here. But the whole dynamics of the community changed. The money went with them. You know, Munster's a thriving town. Maryville is in much better shape than Gary. So, yeah, that's the impact. If Gary doesn't thrive, the rest of the area doesn't thrive. And I think that is critically important. We can't have part of our population barely surviving. The city of Gary has all the infrastructure, you know, the steel mills. It has so much going for it. We can't ignore it. It's like somebody in your family who has cancer and you're just going to ignore them because it's not going to affect you. Well, it is going to affect you. We all need to be good neighbors, and it's not just in Gary and Lake County, but in Porter County in Indiana. As a country, we have to not be so polarized because nobody's moving ahead.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Universities are seeing success in recruiting more women in their computer science programs, but they're making sure that they want to stay in the major is a different challenge. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting Charlotte Tuggle reports in the second of her two-part feature, colleges can struggle to make the classroom as inclusive as possible.
At Rose Holman Institute of Technology, there's only one bathroom. The building only has room for one, and for a while it was men only.
But when the computer science department moved up there, they came into that area and they insisted that it was changed to a female bathroom. And the reason was because it sent a message that, you know, we're a boys' club, right? And they didn't want to do that.
That's David Fisher, a Rose Holman computer science professor. He says it's just one piece of the gender-inclusive puzzle the school is grappling with as the number of women in the major increases. But the environment university officials are most focused on changing is in the classroom. Current student Olivia Ada and alumna Amanda Stouter say in class, girls are often isolated.
But you definitely see male dominance. I know,
and
I'm in
two, as you say, and you have to prove yourself in those.
100%, yeah. I'm in two computer science classes right now. One I'm in, there's only one other girl out of like 30.
That's where student organizations such as Girls Who Code or Wolfpack come in. Their goal is to connect women in the field and provide a support system. Ada says she's relied on upperclassmen to help guide her through the tougher times.
Versus being out in the big scary world, a whole bunch of guys, and you're by yourself, and you feel as if like you're not supposed to be there at times. Mm-hmm. And you have like the side comments and stuff like that. And you're like, why do I want to go through this? But when we have other women like, hey, I'm going through it too, it gets better. Mm-hmm. It makes it a lot easier.
A recent study shows support can have an effect on whether girls study CS or not. For example, if a high school girl doesn't have any friends studying the same thing, she's one-third less likely to continue studying it. But the issue isn't just about classmates, it's also about faculty. And with a shortage of women in the field, female CS professors are especially difficult to find. So Rose Holman's department is trying to home grow its teaching staff. Beyond who teaches the class, universities are also changing how the classes are taught. In Rose Holman's freshman-level CS class, professors assume all of the students have no prior experience. Department head J.P. Meller says only a few drop the major, and about 20 students a year actually change their major to computer science after taking the class, most of them women.
So I think that's a positive thing, right? We're not having students show up and then, you know, I don't fit in and changing majors because of that.
At Purdue University, the introductory CS class is split into those who have programming experience and those who don't, referred to as the black and gold sections of the student body. Department head Sunil Prabhakar says students are less intimidated and more successful when everyone is on the same page.
That distinction, just seeing that you belong, has been a huge, huge boost to the program. And the success of women in the gold section last semester was at par as the overall student success.
Both universities' female CS student percentage is a few points higher than today's national average of 16%. Nationwide, the number of women studying CS reached a peak in the mid-80s, a peak that even current recruiting efforts might struggle to match. That's because about five times as many women earned bachelor's degrees 30 years ago as do now. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle in West Lafayette.
Student safety was a major focus of the House Education Committee yesterday, and as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us, lawmakers approved a set of bills that are centered around bullying and human trafficking.
Representative Wendy McNamara says human trafficking is a problem even in Indiana, but not all teachers know the signs to identify students who might be at risk.
I'm in my 24th year of education, and I had not really understood or known or been educated about human trafficking until I actually came up here.
Her bill would require the State Department of Education to include links on its website about human trafficking. Teachers would also receive more training to learn the warning signs. Some at the bill's hearing voiced concerns about adding even more time to required teacher trainings, but McNamara says it would be worth it.
I don't think, in my opinion, giving up another hour of my life to save the life of a kid, a seven-year-old, from being human trafficked is too much of an ask.
The bill will now go to the House for consideration. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
And this is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Coming up on Sunday at the theater at the center in Munster is an opportunity to enjoy yourself and pick up some culinary tips as well, too, from our next guest, Phil Potempa, who's been doing cooking shows for, seems like forever, hasn't it? Probably to you. How many of this is going to be the, we're talking about the upcoming On the Farm cooking show, which is going to happen there at the theater this coming Sunday.
Well, this is the third edition of this at Theater at the Center, at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in Munster. So this one has a Valentine's theme. It's kind of fun. It's just a relaxing Sunday afternoon right there along Ridge Road. And yeah, I've been doing these for the better part of 15 years because that From the Farm column itself has been around for 15 years. It was in the Times of Northwest Indiana for at least a good 12 years, and then it jumped over. Now it's in the Post Tribune and also at ChicagoTribune.com. So Fans are familiar with it.
I remember some time ago, we talked about this, and maybe just bears repeating again. How did you end up getting involved in doing a cooking column?
Well, it kind of just... Then, you know, basically it arrived out of necessity, I guess. Need and necessity go together. And I had been writing for the feature section, and we had had a columnist that wrote a very popular anchor column that was called Ask Aunt Maxine. And then after that, there was one called Farm Fair. And again, these were local flavor, folksy columns. Readers could write questions. And when those columnists retired, they needed something for that spot. And I had been previously writing a feature each week called The Cook of the Week, which was very popular with readers, but it was not an easy one to do because the idea was that neighbors and friends and churchgoers would just recommend family members and friends, and this feature would quote-unquote write itself. Mm-hmm. But it never wrote itself. It was always hard trying to find people, and I always found that I was trying to go out and campaign to get people. And finally, I told my editors, what if I just took over this existing column because I'm pretty much showcasing family and friends for the Cook of the Week? And they said, well, we'll give it a try and see, but I don't know. That Cook of the Week is pretty popular. And as it turned out, From the Farm has far surpassed that. Nobody remembers Cook of the Week.
I can see why that would be tough. I mean, it wouldn't be tough, I suppose, if you got enough people that would tell you that, hey, I know an aunt or an uncle or a cousin or a sister who has a great hand at cooking meals, you know. Maybe some family member who, you know, as my mother-in-law would have said, feeding for threshers. You
that's
know?
Right. Exactly.
When you're talking about doing huge quantities of food to feed a whole family.
Yes.
That's kind of the attitude that you take at Thanksgiving for a lot
that's
of homes,
right.
I know. But the idea is that it's, you know, it's going out and talking to people. And I can see why maybe this is it's a logical jump from doing something as intimate as that to something as large scale as On the Farm.
Yes, and you know, the From the Farm column has a lot of personality to it, which is what people like. They say, well, we feel like we know your family, and the folksy things that you're doing with the canning and baking and the cooking, and those recipes come from readers that are featured in the column each week, or they also come from family members, and they're all chronicled in the three published cookbooks. You know, From the Farm is the original from 2004, More From the Farm came out in 2007, then in 2010, Further From the Farm. At Sunday Stage Show, all seven recipes whipped up in 2 hours or less will come from that third cookbook, the Red Cookbook, appropriately enough for Valentine's Day, Further From the Farm. So the cookbooks are right there at the Performing Arts Center. You sit back, you relax, you thumb through it, and you follow along on stage. There's a huge demo mirror right over the recreation of our farm kitchen with a 1930s stove. And to make it extra fun, we've even added a courting parlor off to the side. So there'll be a champagne fountain and then a special performance by a barbershop quartet.
That's great. That's great. Give us an idea of the preparation that you have to go through. You say you went to the cookbook, the latest cookbook, and you picked out your seven recipes to be able to put together this seven-course meal. Out of that whole cookbook, how did you happen to pick out the seven that you wanted to be able to feature this weekend?
That's a great question. And they asked me to make it a Valentine's theme, which was certainly fun and inventive. So I picked recipes that sort of lent themselves. So for the first couple courses, an artichoke dip and an asparagus recipe that is baked are delicious. And those are foods that are known to be aphrodisiacs. They're legendary from the times of the Middle Ages and Victorian times. So those were naturals. And then for a main course, a spaghetti sauce recipe that came from the one and only Rudolph Valentino, the silent film heartthrob, who got married at our old Crown Point courthouse in the 1930s to his second wife because he was traveling through. And at the time, you know, that courthouse was called the marriage mill because you could get married within 24 hours, no blood test.
Right.
So that was a natural fit. And then for dessert, a red velvet cake, because red, of course, is our theme. And there's also go-to-bed mints, which are delicious chocolate-filled meringue mints with mint oil from our own peppermint farm.
Now, you have your menu all set up here. You know which pieces you're going to put together of the puzzle, so to speak, for that delicious dinner.
Yes.
Tell us about all the preparation that you have to do to have at least enough, certainly, of the ingredients for each particular dish ready to go, because I'm sure you have to do just as Julia Child and her staff would have to do for public television. You'd have to set up dishes ahead of time so that you have things in some kind of orderly progression.
That's right.
That you can show off to the audience, this is what you do.
Yes.
And you don't have to sit and wait for an hour while something bakes in the oven.
That's right. I have a lot of help, which is fantastic. A lot of hands on deck. The ingredients come from our friends over at Strachan Van Til's. They're very kind to donate all those ingredients. And it does take a lot because you've got to plan each step with what's coming up next and what's, you know, just been finished. And you're right, once in a while through the magic of live stage, you open one of the oven doors and you put it in, and then within minutes you take the other open door, as Julia Child would do, and voila, it is already finished. And then, of course, there's all those dishes that Julia Child on PBS seemed to make magically disappear by just keeping these trays stacked underneath her counter, and somebody else would help with them. Well, I have some helpers that help me with that as well.
She would always have a tray down there with all of the ingredients all measured out in little bowls and ready to scoop together or scrape into the big mixing bowl. So
that's right. You know the process. I have a good helper. Ann Scamhorn is our neighbor, the farmer's daughter down the road, and she's helped with so many of these shows over the years, and she's a frequent name in my farm column. She does a lot of that pre-prep, so she gets the trays ready, then I always kind of do a once-over before curtain time, and then voila, it's showtime.
Now, obviously, you should be there for the From the Farm presentation Sunday at the theater to actually see it happen, but since you've done this so many times in the past for previous shows, what do people get to actually see? You say you progress along here on the stage. Mm-hmm. each stage of each particular dish goes through as you're preparing it together.
Yes.
So you have something ready to go either to pull out of the oven or out of the warmer and here it is.
And, you know, there used to be quite a few of these shows. The Star Plaza would have cooking shows that would come through. Taste of Home was a popular one. They used to sometimes call them the homemakers and home economics shows that would come through at the Porter County Expo Center in Valpo. And those have disappeared. This is a cooking show and even more. So people that even maybe say, I don't really cook, I don't care, mm-hmm. are very entertained by this show. They can sit back, relax. There's lots and lots of prizes, more than $1,000 of prizes that will go home. And then just the set itself, you're looking at a recreation of the farm, including a garden with a fountain that's working and all kinds of live flowers and daffodils and tulips that are potted that will go home again to our wonderful audience members. So it's an awful lot of fun. A couple games, some people come on stage. So kind of think of it as a food and variety show.
Well, it sounds like it's almost like akin to like going to see an exhibit at the Home and Garden show at McCormick Place
that's
or some
right.
place like
that's
that.
It.
Yeah,
that's
interesting.
It.
That's coming up this coming Sunday, beginning at 2:30 in the afternoon. And the tickets are still available, I understand.
They are. If you're a subscriber at Theater at the Center, they're $25, very, very affordable, $30 for everybody else. But again, for a full show and with all the prizes and the sampling and things that you go home with and enjoy, it's fantastic. It's a very, very busy weekend at Theater at the Center. The night before, we have comedy sports happening, which is a fantastic kind of fun family comedy improv. So that's at 7:30 the night before with a great ticket price, $20. And then there's a taco bar before that's offered right in the dining room. So again, it's all about entertainment and eating at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts this weekend.
It seems to be that way. We're talking with Phil Potempa, who is a cooking a columnist for he started out, as you say, with the Times and then became with the Post Tribune. And he is now working as the marketing guy for the Theater at the Center for Performing Arts in Munster. From the Farm is his masterpiece, so to speak,
yes.
You know, and that's what he's going to be presenting to the audience on Sunday, February 4th. And you were starting to tell us a little bit about some of the other programs coming up. You mentioned about the comedy that's going to happen on Saturday, the 3rd of February.
Mm-hmm.
But what else is on the schedule to be shown at the theater here in the weeks ahead?
And this is a big one as well, because, again, food and entertainment, they go hand in hand. I wistfully lament the passing of our Star Plaza Theater, our neighbors right here down the street. But someone needs to pick up that mantle for entertainment, and the Center for Visual and Performing Arts and Theater at the Center has certainly done that in Munster. So there are two or three great headliner shows every single month, in addition to the five main stage shows. The very next weekend, on Saturday the 10th, I'm telling you, this is going to be a lot of fun, brand new to the Theater at the Center stage, Creole Stomp. It's a big Mardi Gras celebration. Mardi Gras this year is the day before Ash Wednesday. So on that Wednesday of Valentine's Day, the 14th is also Ash Wednesday. So on the 13th is our day of kind of Fat Tuesday and having fun. So get it out of your system even earlier on Saturday the 10th. Creole Stomp is this New Orleans band will come do a live concert. But before that, there's a huge Mardi Gras feast in the adjoining dining room with jambalaya and red beans and rice and gumbo, all those good things. And, of course, Mardi Gras king cakes for dessert.
Wow, wow. And there's so many performances, of course, continue on with the Broadway in Northwest Indiana series, too, I
That's
understand.
That's right. So we launched with Steel Magnolias. It's a fantastic play. It's the same as the telling of the 1989 movie that everybody remembers with Dolly Parton and Sally Field and Julia Roberts. That begins at the very end. So February the 22nd goes all the way to the end of March. Fantastic play, heartwarming story of a Louisiana beauty shop and the lives of the ladies that are friends and also that work there.
Wow, a lot of great things coming up here. If anybody is interested in finding out, you mentioned how it's time to get the tickets if you don't have them already for this coming weekend's From the Farm cooking show, but for these other programs, especially the Broadway in Northwest Indiana, you can get these tickets available at the box office if you're not a member.
You can go to the box office or you can call 219-836-3255 or the website. Also, you can order online and order your tickets there and reserve and find out more at www.theater with the RE spelling at thecenter.com. And all the information is there as well. But certainly come out and that Steel Magnolias is just the beginning of an exciting 2018 season of main stage shows. Up next, the spring musical Forever Plaid. And then in the summer, I'm looking forward to this one. I've got to come back and visit with you about The Lady with All the Answers, the story of Ann Landers, the newspaper columnist. And then the fall, it's Ghost the Musical, just like the Whoopi Goldberg and Patrick Swayze Demi Moore film. And then lastly, our big Christmas capper, holiday run for Miracle on 34th Street. So become a season subscriber. September, and you get all of it at a great price.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Phil Potepa is with the theater at the Center for the Performing Arts in Munster, and he's, of course, going to be on stage for the From the Farm presentation that he has been putting on for many years and going to show again, an opportunity to see Phil out there with the help of his many assistants that have helped him prep for this, to be able to put together a 7-course meal, actually performed, if you so speak, or cooked, I suppose, on stage within 2 hours.
That's right.
See how he does it. You have to show up and see how this is going to turn out here. Another of the programs that the Center for the Performing Arts puts on every single year in Munster. And Phil, thanks for spending some time to tell us some of the backstage secrets, if they are really secrets, on how you're able to put together all this great food together for an audience to actually see you enjoy.
My thanks to you and to your listeners, and we'll see you from the farm.
Federal lawmakers are continuing to fight over the future of DACA, which is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that protects immigrants who have come into the country illegally as children. And Indiana Public Broadcasting Eric Sweddle tells us that the uncertainty now is the stalling legislation that in turn would make attending college perhaps easier for students in Indiana.
Indiana is one of just 3 states with a law that prohibits state colleges and universities from offering in-state tuition to undocumented high school graduates. Instead, they must pay the out-of-state or international rate, a cost that can be 3 times more. Democrat state lawmakers want to overturn that 2011 law.
We have this opportunity here to clarify state law, and we want to make sure that we at least have this option if everything falls apart at the federal level.
That's Democrat Senator Mark Stoops. He's wrote one of the 4 bills this session that would give undocumented graduates in-state tuition.
I just find it hard to believe that we can't say, well, we can help you with this next step. We're not helping you with tuition. We're just letting you pay the in-state rate because you were an in-state student.
That change could help Gustavo Flores.
So we're in Shortridge IB, IB World School.
I've been here since the Indianapolis Shortridge High School senior is one of the nearly 10,000 students and others approved for DACA in Indiana. President Trump has ordered the Obama-era program to end on March 5th. And Congress is at odds over how to fix it.
It's a very fearful thing because, like, at any given time after my DACA expires, it's like I could be deported. And what if I take out a loan to go, like, to one of these colleges, and then I get deported, and then I have these loans in America, but I can't pay them, and it's like, what happens then?
Flores was brought to America from Mexico when he was 1. Shortly after, his family moved to Indianapolis. He's attended Indianapolis public schools since he was a child. A reason his family came here, he says, is for him to have opportunities, like college.
If I want to do something for me, something to give back to the community, I want to become a doctor so I can help people.
Flores hopes Indiana will join other states that offer in-state tuition to undocumented students. Most Indiana colleges offer the resident rate to DACA recipients. But if the program goes away, Flores says, he and others won't be able to afford to attend. His school guidance counselor, Nathan Ellis, agrees that barriers are steep for these students.
You know, when it comes to finances, it just doesn't work out because of not being able to pay for it because they didn't get scholarships or they're paying out-of-state tuition. And it's frustrating to see students get kind of demoralized throughout the year and maybe not even choose to apply because they don't see the point.
It's a long shot if Stoops' bill or any of the legislation will be heard this year. There's little to no support in the State House. Republican leaders say they don't see the point. Here's Dennis Cruz, chairman of the Senate Education Committee.
That issue is basically a federal government issue. It's really not designed to be a state government issue. And so hopefully the federal government will take action and give us direction on what to do.
Since there is a law that prohibits the state colleges from offering in-state tuition, from my reading, it seems like that law could be changed as a state issue.
Well, it can be, yes, but I prefer, as the chairman, to have the federal government take action on this issue next.
Back at Shortridge High School, Flores says he's trying to stay focused amidst the national and local debate that will affect his future.
These paintings are basically a color wheel.
He's showing me a series of small paintings he's finishing up for an upcoming senior art show.
It's a good distraction, just to keep my mind at ease, just level myself out.
But he's still frustrated.
Yeah, I'm going to keep my hopes up, but not too high up, because if something like were to like not happen in my favor, I don't want to be so high up that the fall is going to like just devastate me, if that makes sense.
congressional Republicans and Democrats pledge to find a permanent fix on DACA by February 8th. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
WalletHub.com's put out some financial resolutions as we go into 2018, and with us to talk about it, we have analyst Jill Gonzalez. Jill, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe I should say Happy New Year to you, too.
Yes, Happy New Year.
Well, a lot of things that we should probably resolve to do here if we haven't done so already. Let's go down the list. Bring us up to date on some of the most important things that anybody can do when they try to set up a list of financial resolutions to start the new year.
The name of the game here, as with any of your other resolutions, is being realistic. And some of these things obviously are easier than others, but all of them are realistic. Number one, 2017 was a rough year for data breaches, as I keep on saying every year, I don't think this is going to be getting any better anytime soon. So you want to make sure that you're signed up for credit monitoring. These are all free these days. These all should be something that you are not paying for. They're all very proactive. And you get a text, you get an email, if anything a little bit awry is happening with your credit report, and then you can handle it right away. So that's the one thing that's the easiest to check off. It takes 5 minutes. It's free. Something everyone should have going into 2018.
I think it's scary enough that we have one of the reporting services already reporting it having been breached here. I'm afraid that the others are going to probably follow suit.
Well, the Equifax huge breach was obviously something that caught a lot of us off guard, and it affected almost one in two people here. So I would say that hopefully we're not seeing Experian or TransUnion fall victim to that. I think, if anything, they're really amping up security in 2018. But again, if your information's out there, it's out there. It's unfortunately the new normal. So you want to make sure that you're protected.
Right. Okay. What are some of the other things we should resolve to do in 2018?
Well, one, you really do want to budget. I know that sounds a lot like the word diet in January, but you want to, again, be realistic about it. So the easiest way to do that, gather your bills from the past few months, doesn't have to be from entire 2017, and make a list of those recurring expenses. Mm-hmm. Rank them in order of importance, so obviously housing, food, healthcare, taking up the top spots, and then go down to the bottom and start crossing things off until your take-home income obviously exceeds what you plan to spend. And most importantly, a lot of people do make a budget the beginning of the year, and they forget to keep track of it. You know, go back monthly, at least quarterly, to make sure that you're actually abiding by that.
And I suppose, too, that it's very important, obviously, but maybe not to some, that if you happen to have payments that go out of your checking account automatically, and you don't keep track of those, you better keep track of them, or at least make note of which ones are coming out, what time of the month.
Yeah, so this is another good thing to kind of put on your schedule, and it's important. It really does help with budgeting. So we actually recommend paying bills right after receiving your paycheck, and that involves two of those automatic monthly payments, one for right after payday, and another for a couple days before your monthly due date. That second payment helps you avoid interest on any purchases made between the first payment and the end of your billing period, because that is often what gets a lot of people. So, again, set it and forget it. Easy enough to do, but as you said, make sure that you're keeping track and that you have enough money in those accounts to be paying for things.
You've already mentioned here about what we're dealing with, our bills that we have that come out every month here, too. We probably should take a look at any kind of credit card debt we happen to have, too.
Yes. And we happen to have a lot of it. So 2017 was a record-setting year for credit card debt. We hadn't seen levels of that much debt since pre-recession, since the end of 2007. So we're hitting the trillion-dollar mark for the first time ever in terms of credit card debt. And that boils down to around $8,600 per household. We're not saying pay it off by the end of the year. We know that there are mortgages and student loans and auto loans on top of credit card debt, but we are saying plan to pay off 20% of what you owe over the course of 2018. So that boils down to about $1,700 per household. That is doable, and it really will, you know, save on more debt, more interest building up next year.
One other thing, too, that we sometimes forget to keep track of is being able to set aside money not only for savings, but also for an emergency fund. It's very important that we should at least try to expand on that. Tell us how that importance is.
Exactly. So more than half of Americans do not have a rainy day fund for emergencies. And again, 2017 was a bad year for emergencies. when we're looking specifically at natural disasters, when we're looking at medical emergencies, you need to have some type of fluid cash to make sure that you're able to pay for those things without going into more debt. So eventually build a fund with about 12 months take-home income. But realistically, for this year, add 1 month's pay to your emergency fund by the end of 2018, and that will really go a long way in terms of preparing you for anything that comes out of the blue.
We're talking with Joe Gonzalez, who's an analyst for WalletHub.com, about some of the financial resolutions that, if we haven't thought about already, we should probably think about putting them on the list as we go into 2018. We've talked a little bit before here about the concern about the credit report and all. There's, I guess, ways we should also add some extra points to our credit score that will make things easier for us if we have to use them.
Absolutely. So a better credit score ultimately means better deals on your credit cards, on your loans moving forward. And now more and more employers are actually pulling credit scores to kind of gauge how responsible you might be. So there's no reason not to improve that, and it's actually easier than a lot of people think. Mm-hmm. So again, set a realistic goal. We're saying improve your credit score by at least 20 points by the end of 2018. You don't really even have to lift a finger to do that. The best way to improve it is to maintain at least one open credit card account that's in good standing. Even if you have one that's a little bit older that you don't plan on using, keep it on, because that adds credit history to your report. That improves your score. Counts about for 15% of it. But the big chunk that accounts for about 30% of your score is your payment history. And as long as you're making on-time payments and not missing any payments, that's enough to bump you up by 20 points.
One of the other points, too, that's noted in the list of financial resolutions for 2018, and you can see it at WalletHub.com, and you can explain this better than I probably can, Jill, is what's noted as get an A in wallet literacy. What's that all about?
Financial literacy levels in the U.S. are probably lower than we all would imagine. The U.S. tied for 14th globally after Canada, the U.K., Singapore, on how much they know about finances and how simple things like interest or investing works. Most Americans get about a C below on this wallet literacy scale. And we're saying try to get at least an A- by the time 2019 rolls around. There's a wallet literacy quiz actually right on Wallet Hub to gauge how much you might know. And you might surprise yourself either with how much you know or how much you don't. But the good news is that you can educate yourself on that throughout the year, hopefully end the year knowing a little bit more.
I know finally, Jill, is the last point that you note here is something that maybe is easier said than done, but you can explain that too, is to look for a better job. Certainly that's going to help our budget out, to say the least, if we're lucky to find that higher paying job.
Easier said than done is right, but I will say easier done, at least this year. We're looking at a great year for jobs. The unemployment rate is expected to hit 3.9% this quarter, which would be the lowest point in a couple decades. So even if you have a job, this is a good year to know that, hey, other people are hiring. Maybe take that to management and say, I need to feel valued or else I can get a job now more easily than even a year or so prior. So that's good news for job seekers.
Jill Gonzalez is an analyst for WalletHub.com. We've been taking a look at some of the financial resolutions going into 2018. And as always, Jill, thanks for being with us and thanks for the advice. We appreciate it.
Anytime. Happy New Year.
Laurie Latham with the Smoke-Free in the G came on Originally Speaking not long ago to talk about the broad coalition of organizations, local, statewide, and national, that are spearheading the effort to protect Gary residents from the dangers of secondhand smoke. We started the conversation asking about the group's name. How did you come up with that?
About a half an hour. We toyed around with it in a room. You know, there's a lot of smoke-free cities. Smoke-free New Orleans, smoke-free Baton Rouge, and most of the cities just use that smoke-free South Bend, or they use the name of the city in the name. So we toyed around with smoke-free Gary. It didn't quite come together, but most people from Gary, when you say you're from Gary, you say I'm from the G. I'm from the G, wherever you go. So
well,
smoke-free in the G.
That's great. The information that I have talks about the number of partners that are involved with Smoke-Free in the G.
Yes.
Let's go down the list, talk about these partners and how they fit in with the organization.
Sure.
These
We're a very broad coalition. Most of these are state reps, but we also have some national partners. Mm-hmm. So the state rep from the American Heart Association, American Lung Association, American Cancer Society. We call those the organ organizations.
Right.
But then there's also the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights, our Indiana State Department of Health, Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Agency, and then our partners here locally, our Lake County Community Tobacco Prevention Coalition, which is actually led by Franciscan Health, and then our Northwest our Lake County Minority Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Coalition, mm-hmm. and their lead agency is the Northwest Indiana Health Department Cooperative. So a lot of different health partners coming together, and even on those local coalitions, there's a number of other organizations that have also partnered with us on this campaign.
I know one in particular that you've got listed here is the Tobacco-Free Lake County, Indiana.
Yes, Tobacco-Free Lake County, Indiana. That's our community coalition. It's a number of groups who are in that coalition, all partnered for healthier Northwest Indiana.
Now, many of these organizations, like the American Lung Association, American Heart Association, are longstanding. They're decades-long organizations. These others sound like they're relatively young ones?
Well, actually, the other organizations came about after the Master Settlement Agreement, I believe in 1991. Mm-hmm. In 2001, about 10 years later, state of Indiana in our legislature created a Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Agency. That agency then administered grants to all 92 counties in the state of Indiana, and 29 counties that had significant minority populations also was funded to coordinate a minority coalition. So the local coalitions have actually been around for about 17 years. Mm-hmm. This is our first crack at a policy campaign or a comprehensive secondhand smoke ordinance. But things like tobacco-free campuses, getting our schools to adopt policies, all came out of the Tobacco-Free Lake County. Our public housing units, East Chicago was one of the first, even before they passed the federal law, and that came out of our local Minority Tobacco Prevention Coalition. So a lot of work has been done over the last 17 years to build up for Lake County to completely quit smoking.
That's Lori Latham, who is with Smoke Free in the G. And by the way, if you want to quit smoking, Lori offers a toll-free phone number, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.